KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. Stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon. We'll be talking with Tony Woodcock from the New England Conservatory of Music about his Wednesday night presentation with the Juneau World Affairs Council. Daniel Fox, who literally just kayaked overnight to get here, will be here to highlight his Minute of Nature series. We'll learn about a unique fundraiser for teen organizations, and we'll talk with Katrina Pearson and Dan Henry about this year's Northwoods Writers Symposium in Skagway. Weather, cloudy for most of the rest of the day, highs around 56. Tonight, increasing clouds, slight chance of rain. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, another chance of rain. And Thursday night, the same, as well as on Friday. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Transfer of management of the South Unit of Badlands National Park to the Oglala Sioux Tribe has been a years-long process. Recently, public meetings on bison management were canceled, which raised concerns among some Native people and the South Dakota Stock Growers Association. As Jim Kent reports, questions surround what the intentions of the National Park Service and the tribe will be toward landowners and those who lease land near the South Unit.
A plan for general management of the South Unit was enacted in 2006. Badlands National Park Superintendent Eric Bernerman says that plan resulted in a goal to turn the South Unit into a tribal national park managed by the Oglala Sioux Tribe.
That all sounds great, but we don't know what a tribal national park is. It's never been defined before.
That initial definition, says Bernerman, has been forwarded to Washington, D.C. for review prior to the ultimate requirement for any new national park, congressional approval. Despite the length of time involved in that approval process, the Oglala Sioux Tribal Council passed an ordinance to begin laying the groundwork for reintroducing bison to its yet undesignated tribal national park. The tribe's plan to reintroduce bison includes acquiring land adjacent to the South Unit that's either currently owned by tribal members or leased to tribal ranchers for grazing their livestock. Oglala Sioux Tribal spokesperson Chuck Jacobs says the situation is really a non-issue, fueled by a few outspoken members of the Pine Ridge Reservation community. Meanwhile, Badlands National Park Superintendent Eric Bernerman insists that the National Park Service has no plans to condemn anyone's property, neither will it allow for the expansion of the South Unit. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Alaska Native people living along the Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska observe the ice in the river breaking up seemingly in reverse this year. Some elders say it's a sign of climate change. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
The Kuskokwim has been a travel route for the Yupik people since ancient times and still dictates seasonal activities. Just about 20 miles from Bethel, Atmoshok Elder Henry Tikin says he's never seen this happen as he recounts growing up 50 miles inland from the mouth of the river in Bethel.
In my first memories in Bethel, upriver areas like McGrath and Aniak would always break up first. After that, downriver would break up, even though it's closer to the ocean.
Tikin says ice would be much thicker in those days. Breakup would be signaled by loud rumbling from the river caused by ice grinding and breaking against each other, often waking him up at night. He says the climate is changing because of the way people treat the land. Tikin points to trashed field drums along riverbanks as just one of numerous examples. At the mouth of the Kuskokwim from the village of Tuntutuliak, Elder and Pilot James Charles says early downriver breakup is attributed to the lack of snow and thin ice.
The lower area had no snow and the ice was thin, so it broke up first. It usually breaks up last when there's snow.
On the south side of the Kuskokwim Bay, Elder John Alexi says breakup near the village of Eek was similar to just one that occurred about a decade ago. He says warming temperatures were predicted by his ancestral elders.
I used to hear from people who came before me that the weather would change and the winters would be different. It wouldn't be as cold as it used to be.
While breakup was unusual this year, Yupik elders say similar breakups may not be uncommon in the future. In Bethel, I am Charles Enoch.
In May 2012, the Oregon Board of Education voted to ban Indian mascots in schools. The issue then went to the state legislature. The governor signed a bill this year giving schools the opportunity to keep their Indian mascots. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello and welcome to Juno Afternoon. My name is Lori Scandling. My engineer today, as always, is Jeff Brown. Glad to have you with us. Our first guests this afternoon are Jim Clark, who is with the Juno World Affairs Council, and Tony Woodcock, who is president of the New England Conservatory of Music. There is a presentation this evening of the World Affairs Council right here, the KTOO building this evening, and the topic is the El Sistema program, which we'll learn more about as we speak with Tony. Jim, welcome, and can you tell us a little bit about the World Affairs Council and its purpose and what's happening tonight?
Well, the Juno World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that's dedicated to bringing international guests and issues involving international matters to Juno. And we're delighted that today we have at 5 o'clock at the 360 North Studio, Tony Woodcock, who, as you said, is president of the New England Conservatory of Music.
Thank you. Sounds like an interesting program. And we'll learn a little bit more about it right now. Tony, you've been with the New England Conservatory of Music for 8 years, and this year is the fifth graduating class of the Fellows of El Sistema. Why should anybody in Juno care about that? What does that have to do with Juno, Alaska? It's a Venezuelan program.
You might even ask, why am I in Juno at this very moment, besides doing this program at 5 o'clock?
I think that's what I'm asking.
Yeah? Well, first of all, I'm delighted to be here. What a beautiful city you have, and what a wonderful part of the world. And I'm waiting for the sun to shine, but I'm sure it will happen, and is happening as I look out of the window.
Yeah.
What has happened at New England Conservatory is something really very, very exciting. A number of years ago, I took a study tour over to Venezuela to take a look at this program everyone really across the nation and across the globe has been talking about called El Sistema. What is it? What was it producing? Why was it so amazing? What could we learn from it? And we were there for about a week in 2008, and we came back absolutely transfixed and transposed and all the things.
Transformed.
Transformed. And why was this? Because what we experienced there was something really extraordinary. The education philosophy there has used the power of music in the most extraordinary way to transform the lives of children who are in poverty. And of all the children that are in their program, they have more than 300,000 at the moment. About 70% of them come from the poorest areas, the barrios, which surround these cities throughout Venezuela. And the program has started. It started about 35, 36 years ago with this amazing man called Dr. Abreu. And Abreu conceived of this in his garage. And he brought in people, maybe half a dozen, maybe two dozen people to come and perform music, play music with him. And it really exploded from there. And the program is very, very intense. What it does is it gives kids from about the age of four the opportunity to learn music, both through singing and through playing. And the whole thing becomes an amazing virtuous circle of support, because the four-year-old who will then at some point become a 10-year-old and becomes quite proficient starts teaching the four-year-old. And the whole thing moves together in block iterative movements that actually take the experience of music and the power of music into people's lives so that that becomes a real focus, not their poverty, not violence, not some of the strange political things that might be happening in the country, but the power of music to
allow children to study other subjects more diligently and more successfully, to allow their brothers and sisters to look at how successful they are and be inspired to do better, for domestic violence to start falling away because the parents become very proud of the achievements of their children. So this has been an astonishing movement in Venezuela, and the developed world has gone down there to say, well, what can we learn as well? And the founder, his name I mentioned, Dr. Abreu, he invited New England Conservatory, which he's known for a long time, he invited us to develop a brand new training program so that we would train 50 fellows, Sistema Fellows as we called them, over a period of 5 years, and that these would form the backbone of the Sistema movement in North America. And in the very first year that we had this program, back in 2009-2010, one Lori Heggie from Juneau, Alaska, came to us and said that she wanted to study at NEC. We considered her to be a really outstanding student, somebody with wonderful experience already in her life, but somebody who was obviously on a mission with a vision of what needed to happen with music education. And she lived up to every single expectation, both when she was with us and then when she left us and she came back to Juneau. And as we all know, she was Teacher of the Year in 2011. And her school, Glacier Valley Elementary, has won numerous awards, and I can see why now, having spent the last 2 days there. The work that she's doing and the training that we were able, fortunately, to give her all those years ago, I think has made it the most valuable and most extraordinary contribution to musical life in the city.
Tell me what you've seen in the last 2 days visiting Glacier Valley. And that's not the only school where the JAM,
yes,
the Juneau, Alaska,
yeah,
Music Matters,
yeah,
program occurs. Tell us where you visited and what you've seen.
We've only been to the one school. And
okay,
if you like, I feel that we didn't really complete our visit there even, because there's still so much to see and so many people to meet, and we wanted to see the whole gamut of the work that was happening there. So some of my experiences, just randomly, I was corrected roundly by 2 5-year-olds. That will always stay in my memory. First of all, in speaking to a class, I referred to a violin as a machine, and this 5-year-old said, "It is not a machine, it is a musical instrument." And he was absolutely right. Artistically, he was right. Maybe pragmatically, I had a point, but he was correct. And then I was asked to, in another class of 5-year-olds, I was asked, I'm a string player as well, so I was asked to make a contribution to the class and give them some pointers. So I was pointing out one or two things to this little girl. But they're so disciplined that at this moment they had been asked to go into rest mode. So she looked at me as I was trying to get her to put her violin back up. She says, "I am in rest mode now." And that was the end of it.
In case you hadn't noticed.
And but this, for me, it was about the astonishing discipline that is happening there. Classes were completely silent, but not in the sense of terror, but in the sense of expectation and joy. The joy in the music making that was happening, the huge commitment that the kids had to wanting to perform, wanting to get better, to be really focused in the music program. There is some astonishing world-class teaching happening in that school, and I have rarely been so impressed with the school at first visit over these 2 days.
Have you visited a lot of the Sistema Fellows schools,
yeah,
or programs where they're teaching now? Juneau, as you can tell, we're a little bit removed from the rest of the world because of our physical location, and we don't often know how we measure up outside of the boundaries of our own cities. So maybe you could give us a bit of a description.
Well, I would say that every single Sistema program happening around the states is different, because unlike the Venezuelan model, which is very centralist, it's centrally funded, it's centrally administered, that's not the case in the states. What we have in the states is a situation, and I totally applaud it, where an organization or an individual wants to produce and create and develop something which is unique to the needs of this community. And that's exactly what I see here in Juneau, Alaska. Other people around the country have done very, very different things. They've done complete choral programs, or they have been picked up by a major chamber orchestra or a major symphony orchestra. LA Philharmonic, for instance, it has employed at least two of our fellows in recent years. The St. Luke Chamber Orchestra has also employed one of our fellows to reinvigorate their connection with their community. So it's as multifarious as you could possibly think, given every need that happens in this country and the individuals who are now able to respond to that.
But it sounds like what you've seen here in our little community is something that is promising.
It's more than promising. I think what you have here is an exemplar. You have a culture at the school which, if you could just bottle it and just sell it on the streets or sell it around the country, you would change the world. You really would. So you may be thinking, well, Juneau is perhaps a small city in the northwest of America, but it's a very, very important one. And it's one which is doing amazing work, and it's work that the rest of the country can really learn from.
That's gratifying to hear, particularly because I previously worked for the Juneau School District, and it's always rewarding when people take time to be in a school and mm-hmm. see the kind of wonderful work that is happening. What do you see for the future of the JAM program or Juneau Alaska Music Matters here in Juneau?
I think I would be very confident that it would have a wonderful future. But I know that there are always competing priorities with budgets, and there are always terrible budget cuts that happen, and people have to fight to keep things alive. And I know that Laurie Heggie has been very successful in doing that. But all I would say is that I think the greatest investment any society, any community, any city can make is the education of its young. And I think that that's maybe such an obvious statement to make, but it's one which I think is a very important statement to keep repeating. So I know that there are many individuals and foundations out there who are very supportive and very generous to JAM. But it would be wonderful to think that there could be more resources that could be given to them, because just seeing what they've started here, if they had just a bit more children's lives would be transformed, and more families, I think, would just feel the benefit and feel the power of music as it touches their children.
Thank you so much for your time, Tony. We've been speaking with Tony Woodcock, who is the president of the New England Conservatory of Music, the school which hosts the El Sistema Fellows Program, and one of the very first fellows who graduated was Laurie Heggie, a music teacher out at Glacier Valley School, who, following her training in El Sistema, began the JAM, J-A-M-M, music program. Tony will be speaking at 5 o'clock tonight here at KTOO at the 360 North Studio. Again, that's at 5 o'clock tonight. And, Jim, is it free?
It's free. And so we're hoping that everybody will come out for Juneau World Affairs Council tonight.
Great.
And listen to Tony.
Pleased to know that the World Affairs Council is hosting someone of your caliber, and thank you for being with us.
My great pleasure.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, and with me is our next guest, Daniel Fox, who, as I said at the beginning of the show, literally kayaked here overnight. First, let's talk a little bit about that, and then, Dan, we'll talk about the Minute of Nature's a nature series that you're working on. But I need to hear a little bit about your overnight kayaking adventure and what you saw.
Yes, so I've been in Juneau, I think, for about over 2 weeks. The first, I went to Pack Creek. I kayaked to Pack Creek and saw the bears. And then I came back, spent some time at the Manitou Hall Glacier, which you saw the photo I just saw to you of the ice cave. It was actually in an iceberg. So I kayaked back, and I saw this iceberg that was blue, like really blue. And like, as I came closer, I saw this little opening. And I started to venture inside. I was not feeling too secure, to be honest.
But you got the great shot.
I got the great shot. And this morning, I kayaked from Yaku Glacier. I left at the high tide at 7 p.m. and I arrived at 2 p.m. and
2 a.m.
At 2 a.m., yes. And the great thing is when I arrived at the entrance of the river, the Yaku River, I came upon a small pod of orcas, and then I had actually one big male navigate at 30 yards to my 7 o'clock for about 10 minutes. He was following me. And then I had some humpback whales, which they surprised me on a couple of occasions because they were kind of really close to the shore, and they were like between me and the shore. And in the dark, like, I could not really see.
And they're big.
And they're really big. So I would hear, like, the psh, and I was like, okay. And the other thing that was really cool last night was the water bioluminescent. It was not this really kind of glowing in the dark, but it was every time my paddle would go in, it was this, like, bucket of crystal suddenly that was just, like, appearing. So within my field of view, I had these two white spots going just in and out constantly until I arrived at 2 a.m. at Sheep Creek. And then I was then with my headlamp trying to figure out exactly how to come out. But everything turned out pretty good.
How magical.
It was magical.
When you told me about the overnight kayak trip, the first thing I said was, were you afraid? And you said no.
No, not at all. I mean, it's usually it's more of a perspective of fear that takes over. But if you relax and kind of let the moment carry you, you find yourself quite at peace. I mean, the orcas are, you know, they're minding their own business. If they want to come to see you, they'll come to see you. But there, you have more, you know, I had actually a little bit of weather, strong wind coming out, and that was, you know, I was not scared, but there was more anxiety at that moment than with the whales. It was just, you know, a fascinating midnight paddle. You got to take advantage of these, like, kind of bright nights.
Indeed, you are. Well, Dan, let's talk a little bit about your background, what you do for a living, and why you're in Alaska.
So my job is actually traveling and spending a lot of time in nature, in the wilderness, and I tell stories, and I do photography. One of the things that I believe is that, yes, there's an extreme awareness of the natural world, but there's an extreme disconnection. And when you spend time in the wilderness, usually it's your perspective of life changes, and it's a humbling experience. And there's a lot of teachings that you get, which now we don't have because our nature dose is like on the internet, on TV. It's a concept. It's something pretty that we put on the wall, but we don't get the teachings that usually comes with it. So I try to bring these stories back to the table, and I have a sponsor, Wilderness Systems, which kind of sponsors my outings. And last year, I was here kayaking from Sitka to Una. and now I'm back to do a little bit, and now I'm heading to Kodiak Island, in which I'm going to be working with the Office of Tourism to capture the spirit of the island, again, kayaking, backpacking, doing photography, and also developing, as like you talked a little bit about, the Minute of Nature. So the Minute of Nature is my new little baby. It's the CBS Morning Show has had for like many years the Moment of Nature. And when I was out on Vancouver Island, I was trying to figure out a video concept, a video format that would enhance my work and fit what I do. And we live in a world where even sitting down and doing nothing for 60 seconds is hard. It's really, I mean, even myself, I have to, you know, concentrate myself. So I said, why not coming up with this Minute of Nature, which it would give me a platform where I can share insights that I have with people or share a passage of a book that I'm reading, and then give this unedited 60 second of nature footage, something that either inspired me or I thought was pretty, and just ask people just for these seconds to do nothing else. And even if it's just like closing your eyes, the exercise is not, you know, to watch something, but to break your day for one little minute of your day to just zone out and be in the moment. So these Minutes of Nature for me are what I'm spending a lot of time on right now.
So Wilderness Systems is your sponsor.
Yes.
And where would those who want to experience this Minute of Nature find your work? Is there an online, maybe that's an oxymoron, but
it
how
is.
Would they
it
find
is.
That Minute of Nature through, you know, the magic of the internet, for example? Because you just showed me a fabulous picture of the ice cave and the berg.
Yes.
So how are you going to share this with the larger world?
I have a website, wildimageproject.com, and I'm quite active on social media platforms, which is quite ironic. But, you know, these platforms are what, it's like, you know, TV. It's, they allow you to publish your work, and if you have a message or if you have a brand, you can't ignore these platforms. So I use Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, latterly, all of them. And so I will post all of these photos, and the channel for the Minute of Nature is on Vimeo, but you can access it through my website, wildimageproject.com.
How did you get into this kind of work? As you were describing what you do for a living, which is travel,
yes.
Really into beauty.
Yes.
It sounds like a dream job. How did you come to this?
It sounds like a dream job. I mean, traveling into beauty. The world, one thing that I love about the world is that it's nothing is really pretty or ugly. Things are what they are, and you take whatever you want to take. But it's certainly not just a walk in the park. And it's you have a lot of down moments. It's a path that, you know, most of the time you face on your own. You know, it's a package. I would never trade what I'm doing with anything else in the world. But I always make sure to tell people that they see one side of the picture. But the reality is, at the end of the day, it takes a lot of commitment. And it takes, you do it for the heart because you love it, not because of the prestige or the money. That comes after, if it comes. But
I would guess the physical exertion as well is something
also,
that's constant, because kayaking,
yeah,
and a strong headwind is not an easy task.
That, and, you know, on Monday I spent the entire day in the tent because it was
raining.
It was raining, and, you know, there's a lot of, you find yourself in a lot of times where it's just you, your thoughts, and you have to think about many things or nothing about a lot of things. But to come back about your question, how did I get there? When I was young, this is what I've always wanted. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to sail the world and study the whales. And I took a really long detour. I ended up in marketing in New York, business, trying to make it in the corporate world. And
where did you grow up?
I grew up in Montreal. And then when I was 21, I moved to New York. So
you were in urban areas. You were not living in a rural area at
that
time.
No, I was more, well, we could say the suburbs. I mean, I was raised in the weekends. My mom would open the door and she would say, you know, get out of the house and don't come back until, you know, dinner or lunch, preferably dinner. But it was back in that time, in that reality. Today, it's a totally different reality. But this is what I grew up in. I always loved kind of venture out and explore my own. And I had a path that took me in a different way, you know, for many years. And, you know, to make a long story short, I found myself at one point where I had to reassess how I want to spend my next 10 years. The previous 10 years not really exactly been the ones that I wanted. And so I sold everything and just basically started. And it's been 5-6 years now.
Have you traveled all over the world or primarily in North America?
North America, South America, Europe. Haven't ventured to Asia nor Africa, but definitely will. Right now I'm like concentrating really in America. There's so much to see just in this country. And just Alaska, like one could spend one entire life discovering Alaska.
So you are in Southeast now. You were here in Southeast, what'd you say, about a year ago?
Yeah.
And you're headed up to Kodiak. Have you visited other parts of the state?
Nope. And I'm looking forward to. Now I'm making a commitment that every year I'm going to come back and I'm going to explore a little bit more. And I've had tremendous help and support. I mean, from the Office of Tourism here in Juneau to the Alaska Marine Highway System, to the Office of Tourism in Kodiak. Everybody's kind of been, you know, been really helpful.
And Daniel, Wilderness Systems, is this a business? Does it make gear? What is Wilderness?
Kayak.
Kayaks. Okay.
They make wonderful kayaks. And the one that I have right now, it's a big one, 17.5 feet long. So I can carry a lot of stuff.
How much does it weigh? I'm in the market for a kayak.
It doesn't weigh. I mean, it's always like I carry it on my own and everything. So I would not. I think it's 55 pounds, but don't quote me on it.
All right.
But it's gonna help me quite. I mean, it's gonna be extremely useful because my next big project is I'm starting a non-profit foundation to raise money to send underprivileged teens to wilderness camps, immersion, not just like a weekend, but a three and a half week or something like that. So my first, to kick off the fundraising, I'm going to kayak from Victoria on Vancouver Island all the way to San Francisco.
Your home place now.
So that's going to be 2.5 months of paddle, a 1,000 mile.
Well, thank you for taking a moment to share your adventures. The paddle last night sounded absolutely beautiful. We've been talking with Daniel Fox, who is traveling through Alaska as part of his Wilderness Systems sponsored work. You can find his pictures at wildimageproject.com and his videos on Vimeo. He is also producing the Minute of Nature series, and his next stop will be in Kodiak. Very inspiring. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 21st of May, 2014. 1881, on this day, Clara Barton founded the American Red Cross. She was a shy young woman with a stutter. She began teaching 1839, age of 18, overcame her shyness. And early on, Clara Barton said, "I may sometimes be willing to teach for nothing, but if paid at all, I shall never do a man's work for less than a man's pay." Took a job in 1854 at the U.S. Patent Office in Washington, worked hard, and indeed, within a year, was making a salary equal to that of the men in the office. By 1861, war was breaking out, and when the Battle of Bull Run took place not so far from Washington, a major defeat for the Union, Clara Barton read reports of the battle and realized that the army had not seriously considered or provided for wounded soldiers. So she began to ride along in ambulances. And afterward, after the war, traveling to Geneva, she learned about the International Red Cross and founded the American Red Cross on this day in 1881. It's the birthday of Alexander Pope, London, 1688. Catholic family, and there was a wave of anti-Catholic sentiment in England at the time, so he was not allowed to attend public school. His aunt taught him to read, a priest taught him Latin and Greek, and he fell in love with the works of Homer when he was only 8. He developed tuberculosis, which affected his bones and stunted his growth. He was a hunchback, about 4'6" tall. Not many of his poems are read today, but he's very often quoted. It was Alexander Pope who said, "To err is human, to forgive divine, and fools rush in where angels fear to tread." Pope said, "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pyrian spring." And it was Alexander Pope who said, "Be not the first by whom the new are tried, nor yet the last to lay the old aside." Here's a poem for today by Robin Becker entitled Hospice. I wanted to believe in it, the word softer than hospital, but still not home. Like any other frame house on the street, it had a lawn, a door, a bell. Inside, our friend lay, a view of the garden from her room, but no lift to raise her from the bed. A sword, the sun plunged across the cotton blankets. I wanted dying to be Mediterranean, curated, a villa, like the Greek sanatoria, where the ancients cared for their sick on airy porticos and verandas, with stone paths that led to libraries. A nurse entered her room and closed the door. For the alleviation of pain, I praise Morpheus, god of dreams, unlocking the medicine drawer with a simple key, narcotic placed beneath the tongue. In the hall, the volunteer offered us coffee. How could I think the Mozart in G major we played to distract her could distract her? Or marble sculpture in the atrium. A poem by Robin Becker, Hospice, from Tiger Heron, published by University of Pittsburgh Press and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This station receives support from Canyon Hydro, providing maintenance, inspection, and repair services to remote hydro producers with fly-in service available. Information about these services can be found at canyonhydro.com.
And welcome to Juno Afternoon again. We're speaking with Ginny Del Rosario about a unique fundraising event for teenagers that is set for Friday evening from 5 to 10 at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. Ginny, what is the Rock the Runway, and why are you involved? Your kids are all grown up.
I know. My kids are grown up, but Mia's mother is a best friend of mine, and she asked me to come over and said, from a mother to a mother, please go. He said, spread the word.
And Mia is a JDHS student who's putting on a fashion show.
Yes. She's very active in extracurricular activities, and, you know, my mother have to spend extra money to send their children to swimming tournaments, the swimming camp, and all of these activities in school, which is... You know, at least the parents have to dole out money for this one. And that's why they were saying we need to continue our extracurricular activity to keep children, you know, keep the children away from trouble, of course, you know, or keep them happy, you know. Extracurriculars keeps them healthy and strong too, you know, being active.
Absolutely.
So we support our teens to be productive all year round, for them to be able to cope up with their studies at the same time, you know, staying healthy and strong, and you know. So I think this is Mia's contribution, or as a very active athlete herself, she said, let's do fundraising events for teens and let the teens get involved. And when the teens get involved, the parents get involved, and it will be a happy get-together, and at least at the same time, you know, fundraising for a good cause.
And Mia's last name?
Ruffin.
Okay, thank you. And it looks like it starts at 5. There is a $10 admission that includes hors d'oeuvres and refreshments. And then for kids who are age 5 to 10, it's just a $5 admission.
Mm-hmm.
And the poster says that you're highly encouraged to donate to teens' respective clubs and organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like the admissions, as well as, you know, hoped for donations, will go to a variety of clubs, not just one.
Yes, not one. If you can donate to your choice, you know, of club that you want to donate, or your child, where your child is involved in. And at the same time, you know, there are some of parents or volunteers cooking for food. All of these things here, all of the food provided, I think, are donated by parents somehow in one way or another. They have to pull in together so that the fundraising will have, you know, more funds to come in and not spend for other expenses. So the parents pulled in together and they donated food. So so they'll have enough for everybody who are coming in. And also the selling of the slightly used clothes and jewelry, there's some vendors who are there that are also selling it for a very low price so that everybody can avail of it.
I think it's exciting that the fashion show will be of new, slightly used
mm-hmm.
clothes and jewelry.
Yes.
So it'll be a combination
yes.
of items that are brand new, and then they can be for sale as well.
Yes. So instead of a garage sale, you know, this is one way of putting it, like garage sale is like a penny or two and everything, right? Or $2, $3. At least you can see the clothes, and you sometimes say, I like the clothes, and someone says, I like it too. Maybe you could bid for it. You know?
And it's a fashion show.
It's
so
a fashion
it sounds
show.
Like Mia Ruffin and her friends.
And her friends.
Will
a
be
lot
modeling.
Of teens. Yes, will be modeling, and then they're donating their time and money into for a good cause, and which is going to be very good. This will start something good for the community, and the teens will get involved, and this will be just maybe not one-time thing, you know. This will be a continuous process for teens to get involved.
And will the teenagers decide where the proceeds go?
Yes. I think they have their own respective clubs to donate.
So there's a team of
organizers
who are youth,
yes.
who will choose then the recipient.
That's right.
For the
and,
proceeds.
Yes, Mia is very involved in swimming and in other school activities. So I think this is something good. And I said, okay, to the mama, from a mama to a mama, I'm coming over to the station and promote your fashion show for a fundraising.
Well, it certainly is true. If you want parent involvement, get their kids involved first. Parents are proud and are willing to help and definitely will show up. So I want to emphasize this is a public event,
mm-hmm.
and it's a fashion show and a sale for all ages that will feature new and slightly used items as well. And it is hosted and organized by teens with the support of their parents, and it's set for Friday evening.
That's
5
right.
to 10 across the street here at the Jack.
At the Jack.
$10 for grown-ups. And they receive hors d'oeuvres and refreshments. There will be a no-host bar as
mm-hmm.
well. Parents are making the goodies and the food, and I see
mm-hmm.
it says all you can eat, so that's encouraging.
That's right.
And then little ones ages 5 to 10 will be charged just $5.
$5 admission.
Now, if someone wanted more information, Jenny, where would they find additional information? Or is there a number they could call if they wanted to help? Or
well, I think Rochelle is Mia's mother, and they can call. The brochures are all over the place.
Oh,
and,
very good. Okay.
As I say, like this on Facebook, I don't know how to find it. So, but I think if they put this there, I think they are on Facebook. So
it does
and
say
Rochelle,
Facebook, so probably
yes.
under they could try Mia Ruffin, M-I-A-R-U-F-F-I-N.
I am, yes.
or Mia's Sweet Gesture.
That's right.
The subtitle of the event. So,
oh, that's right.
Folks can find more information about Rock the Runway, which is Friday evening, by looking on Facebook.
Yes, 23rd.
All right. Thank you, Jenny. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for letting me come and spread the word.
Absolutely.
For our teens. Anything for our teens. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
This is Bird Note. This rhythmic whistled song is a quintessential sound of woodlands in the eastern U.S. But few birds are more ready to visit your backyard than its singer, the tufted titmouse. And it's a fine thing that they do, because a tufted titmouse has just about everything you could ask for in a backyard bird. Petite and strikingly elegant, it has a jaunty crest and a silver-hued back set off by salmon-orange flanks. Its snappy image adorns many a bag of birdseed. It's as perky as a chickadee. In fact, it's a cousin to the chickadee. And as it comes boldly to sample your seed or suet feeders, the tufted titmouse will even hang upside down like an acrobat. Like to see even more of your local titmice? Put up a nest box with a small opening. You might even see three birds attending the nest, as one of last year's brood sometimes stays on as a helper. But what's in that peculiar name, titmouse? Well, it turns out the name descends from two ancient Anglo-Saxon root words. Tit, from a word meaning something small, and mouse, from a word applied to any small bird, as well as that little rodent. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
With us now is Katrina Pearson, and on the phone, Dan Henry from Skagway, to talk about this year's Northwoods Writers Symposium, which will be up in Skagway. Welcome, Katrina. Glad to have you here. We're going to speak with Dan as well. First, Katrina, tell me a little bit about what Northwoods is and what your role is. I know you're one of the organizers, but tell me a little bit more about that.
I am. I'm actually more of a volunteer, but Northwoods is a writer's symposium up in Skagway that features a really incredible writing faculty and participants. One of the wonderful things about it is this ratio between writers and participants, and it's not very large, so you get a lot of one-on-one time with the writers, and then you're in Skagway, which is an amazing and kind of inspiring setting anyway. I'm kind of a volunteer, and then I'm also a business sponsor.
What is your, tell us a little bit about your business and how it supports the symposium.
Well, I own a business, which is an Alaska art and book wholesale company, and then I have my own publishing company.
It's exciting. And do you yourself write?
I knew you were going to ask that. I normally say I do not. However, at last year's symposium, I did work on some essays, and I have done more writing than I ever have.
I should say she's pulling out a 4-inch manuscript. No, that's...
Hi, Katrina. Laurie.
Not quite accurate. Hi, Dan. Glad you could join us from Skagway. What's your role, Dan, in this symposium? And please tell us when it is.
Yeah, the symposium is the 28th, May 28th through the 31st, and as Katrina was saying, it's a wonderful assembly of great writers around the state. We always have somebody who I call a megafauna who comes from outside, and then there's a wonderful ratio with the students. Usually we have about 10 faculty and 25 to 35 students, so people get a lot of attention. And my role is program director. I've been with it since the beginning for 5 years.
Tell me a little bit about who some of your faculty will be this year.
Sure, Laurie. Actually, our main person, our keynote this year, is Simon Winchester. We're really excited to have him here this year. He is a longtime journalist. He has a degree in geology from Oxford. He's a professional geologist, but then his writing turned to journalism, and he's published author of 21 books, including a couple books that I've read recently, three books of his I've read recently, Professor and the Madman, which was one of his earlier ones, also a book called Krakatoa, which explains everything about Krakatoa, the island that blew up in the 1880s, and then just recently I read Crack at the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906, fascinating book. So he's quite amazing and has been up in Alaska before. He drove through Alaska on a whirlwind tour to observe places where fault lines had crossed. And that's a whole other story. But he's going to be great. We also have several Alaska authors who are coming up, and some folks for the first time, some folks are repeat. And a Yukon person, Michael Gates, from Whitehorse. He writes a regular column for Whitehorse newspaper called The History Hunter. He has a couple of books out, Dalton's Gold Rush Trail and Gold at 40 Mile about Yukon history and Alaska history. We're excited to have him there. Also, Lael Morgan, who is no stranger to Alaskan. She's been around for a long time, journalist, known for her fabulously selling book, The Good Time Girls and Eskimo Star. We also have this year's Alaska Writer Laureate, Nora Dauenhauer, with her husband Richard. And they, of course, are titans in the Tlingit history world and have produced an incredible amount of work, and are also poets, and they will be showing their poetic side as well during the symposium. Let's see, other people, Nick Jans, also very familiar to Alaskans. He's just finishing a big contract with a back east publisher, A Wolf Called Romeo. That story is not unfamiliar, of course, to people in Juneau. Also, he wrote The Grizzly Maze from a few years ago, and is probably his best known book is Last Light Breaking. Deb Vanassa from Anchorage, her recent work is Wealth Woman about Kate Carmax and the Gold Rush. Fascinating new book, and she's also the co-founder of 49 Writers, which many folks are aware of as a statewide blog about local writing. And two more people, Heather Lendy from Haines. Her latest work is Finding the Good, and she's also a Woman's Day columnist. And John Straley, of course, from Sitka, and his latest work, a lot of people have been reading and talking about Cold Storage, Alaska. And I'll catch my breath for a moment.
Dan, I'm excited, and I'm not even going. I would very much like to, because this has been recommended to me by some other local people who were very enthusiastic about the experience they had there. Katrina, tell me a little bit about what a person's day looks like during the symposium. Is it all group settings? Is it panel discussions? Is there writing time, I assume? Are there workshops where you get feedback? Tell me a little bit about your experience there and what a participant can expect.
Right. Well, you know, it's really all of those things. There's kind of a morning gathering that sets the tone for the day and a schedule. There are kind of these concurrent panels, discussions, and writing sessions. There are breaks for lunch. There are excursions where you board the train and go on a trail ride with some of these authors, which is a wonderful setting, you know, to kind of glean information from them. There's a banquet, you know, Saturday night in Skagway. There are participant readings and faculty readings in different places around town. There's quiet time to write. And I think that Dan built into the schedule this year, and you please correct me, Dan, if I'm wrong, some early morning, late night kind of writing time. You know, so there's all kinds of things going on. There's book signings during the day. And I think each participant also gets some scheduled time with an author. So if you are a participant, you want to hang out with Heather Lendy, then you can pick her brain and talk to her and spend time with just her if you schedule that with her. So that's one of the other wonderful aspects of the symposium.
Now, do people stay together in a housing situation, or are they responsible for finding their own lodging, meaning is it kind of an intensive residency for the weekend, or do people make independent plans?
The participants mostly make independent plans, I think, and then the faculty and the writers that are on the panels this year, they have places that Northwards helps them, you know, with housing and that sort of thing.
If somebody wanted to learn more about the conference, do you have a website where they can see some of the details?
Yeah, there is a Northwoods Writer Symposium website. If you Google that, we're also on Facebook, and you can find us in either of those places. The full schedule is on the website.
And folks should know it's Northwoods,
right.
Not Northwards, W-A-R-D-S.
Right.
Not that. I think that they might not quite hear that enunciation,
right.
And it's Northwoods. Mm-hmm. So is it www.northwoods.org?
It is not. It is www.nwwriters.com.
And writers with two S's.
Writers with two S's.
Yes,
okay.
NW writers with two S's.
Dot
but certainly
com.
Northwoods, Northwoods or Skagway Writers thing will get you there. You know, any of those.
Great. What's the cost for a participant, aside from the housing and the food, to participate in the symposium and have the opportunity to interact with these writers? What is your tuition? Do you know, Dan? I assume you do.
Yeah.
You're the organizer.
Yeah, Wednesday night through Saturday night, $300, and that includes meals and outings and everything.
The whole package, other than your housing and the getting there.
And
your dock back in the water?
I'm not in Skagway right now, but I've been checking around, and I hear it's up and about ready to have regular use.
Terrific. So people can get there by water or, of course, by small plane. That's exciting. Now, are people expected to share with one another, say, via a blog or email after the symposium? Is there some kind of connection post-experience?
Yeah, we've been talking this year about beginning a publication that comes out of the symposium itself. And so I'm definitely going to be meeting with people about putting works together and encouraging people to do that, and even, you know, have a journal that comes out in the fall from works that people who have been in the symposium who are submitting. And in the past, we've also had a lot of blogs, a lot of connections. Certainly, we send out a directory. And so it really is a, group building experience. So we continue to generate a lot of creativity.
Thank you so much, Dan. We are talking with Katrina Pearson and Dan Henry about this year's Northwoods Writers Symposium in Skagway. It's set for May 28th through the 31st. That's a Wednesday through a Saturday. And while you need to get yourself there and a place to stay, the tuition is $300 for all 4 days, which includes all meals and excursions. And it sounds like some terrific opportunities to interact with successful authors. You can find more information about the symposium at www.nwwriters.com. Thank you so much for your time, each of you. It sounds like an inspiring weekend, and I appreciate your talking with us about it.
Thanks, Laurie.
Well, thanks very much, Lori, and great to hear from you, everybody out there, Katrina, and look forward to seeing folks next week.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dan.
Yep.
The deadline for the Path to Prosperity Business Development Competition is fast approaching. Do not miss your opportunity to receive a $40,000 grant and get the support you need to start or grow your business. The program is open to all residents of Southeast Alaska. Applications are due May 30th by 5 p.m. For more information and to apply, visit us online at www.p2pweb.org. This message is brought to you by the Ha'ani Community Development Fund and the Nature Conservancy.
Looking at the weather, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain for the next couple of days, but on Memorial Day weekend, just mostly cloudy, which I've always interpreted to mean potentially partly sunny as well. No rain in the forecast Saturday through Monday, but there are clouds on the way. Tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, Shona Strasser will talk with Zan and Dan Rayner of Stevens Puppets about their shows next Tuesday. Meryl Jensen will be here to highlight May's Public Garden Day and a benefit for the Jensen Olson Arboretum. Todd Hunt will be here with a preview of the Juno Wind Ensemble Spring Concert. Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. That's Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and More, tomorrow at 3 on a Juno afternoon.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in